financial literacy, and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Raham.
Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Raham. I'm Jess Tyler. Good morning.
Good morning, Jess. How are you?
I am excellent. And today we're talking about life insurance policies, which is a coincidence because I saw this commercial and I wanted to get your take on it.
It was this commercial that came on that basically said, like, if you're overweight and don't take care of yourself, call Big Dave because we'll insure even you. And I just thought, is this working? But it must be because they're advertising.
So I wanted to talk about that. And then the other question I had was, is it ever enough if you just take the life insurance option you get from your employer because it's so cheap?
So what you get from your employer, let's say it's three times your salary, is it enough? Well, that's one question we'll go over about how you figure out how much is enough. But is it enough for you? Maybe, and maybe while you're still working, what you need to understand is what happens to it when you leave work. Do you get to keep a reduced amount? Like, let's say you have $150,000 of coverage while you're working. If you leave, does your employer say you get to keep a $5,000, say, paid up policy, or you get to pay the premiums on it and keep it?
Mm-hmm.
So they can say anything they want about it, basically. It's one of your benefits. So you might want to ask your HR people, you know, what happens to my life insurance when I leave? So that you know, because one of the biggest things about life insurance is, and everybody will tell you this, if you buy it when you're young and healthy, it will be cheaper. The rub is that when you're young and healthy, you often can't afford much life insurance.
Or you're not really thinking about it. You know, you think you're going to be young and healthy forever.
Yeah, it's true. But okay, so let's talk about Big Dave for a minute.
Okay.
What he's talking about, I'm assuming, and I've not heard the ad, but I'm assuming that he's talking about something we call guaranteed issue life insurance. So just to give you a rough overview, there's so many different kinds of life insurance. There's whole life. There's variable life. There's universal life. There's variable universal life. There's term insurance.
It gets confusing.
Yeah, it gets confusing. And most people don't start by saying, what kind of life insurance do I need? They start by saying, how much life insurance do I need? And then the usual comment is, I'll just get term because it's cheaper. Or, no, I want permanent insurance because I don't want it to end.
Can you explain the difference between term and permanent or term and life?
Absolutely. So term and permanent. The terminate one is where you're going to die immediately, and the perm one is where you get your hair done.
Right.
No, term and permanent life insurance. Okay, so term insurance is just what it sounds like. It's there for a certain term.
Okay.
Right? It might be 10-year term, 15-year term, 20-year term, 30-year term.
That basically means you have to die within that time period.
Wow, that's a little harsh.
I didn't pretty that up at all.
Jess.
I know. But that's basically what it means, right?
I don't think anybody would buy a policy that says they have to die within the term.
If you don't die within this 10 years, you're getting nothing.
But that's kind of how it works, actually. If you don't die within that period of time, the premiums you've paid are gone, right? They've been paying for death benefit only, no cash value, and the policy ends. Okay, so that's term insurance. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about how term can benefit you in a number of ways, but that's how term insurance works versus some sort of permanent insurance, like any kind of whole life, variable life, universal life, variable universal life, those things that build cash value in some way.
Okay.
That's the basic difference. If you don't know if you have term or you have some whole life product and you can't find the words on your statement, do you build cash value or do you not? Now, the gray area, there's always a gray area. You might have something like, say, a universal life policy built on a term chassis. So you might be paying for permanent insurance, but as cheaply as you can. But it's still permanent. It's just not building any or much cash value.
Okay.
So it is. It's a hot mess, right? Insurance
for sure.
Is a hot mess. But there are ways to sort through it. So that's the difference between term and permanent insurance. And permanent insurance, we would call some form of whole life contract. As
okay.
I said, universal life, variable life, any of those are under the permanent insurance umbrella.
And the whole life is obviously going to be more expensive.
Yes, it is going to be more expensive. And depending on the kind of whole life you buy, It will cost you more in premiums than some others. For instance, a universal life policy may be less expensive than what we call a plain vanilla whole life policy. The question isn't always one of expense, though. The question is often one of value.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how expensive was your term policy if you paid for it for 25 years and didn't use it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It did cover your death benefit, and that's what you wanted it to do. But now you're 25 years older, you may not be in good health, and you might be in the market for insurance again, and now you're going to really pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas some whole life types of policies, universal life is a good example, where you might be able to pay for it for a period of time, it builds up enough cash value to start paying for itself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still permanent insurance. It's not that one of these is better than the other. It's that you have to find the right fit for you.
Is there a time that you would recommend someone get either a term or a whole life insurance policy? Is there a certain age or other factors?
Well, if you're going to die, I think it's a good idea to have some life insurance.
But I mean, would you take it out when you're 30 or would you take it out when you're 60?
Yeah, clearly taking it out when you're younger helps. But life changes. You might need a lot more insurance when you're 30 and you have three small children at home
mm-hmm.
and not a lot of assets and a wife or a husband that maybe can't support themselves without your income.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, that's a cause for life insurance, right?
Yeah.
You might take it out if you have a business partner who can't run the business successfully if you die without some real capital. So you might take out life insurance and make the business partner the beneficiary on it. So if something happens to you, the business can continue to run, thereby perhaps supporting your family.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many reasons to buy life insurance. Some people will buy it to build cash value tax-free. If they buy a whole life policy and it's funded a specific way, it doesn't breach some guidelines, which mm-hmm. you know upfront, you know, then you might build cash value in there tax-free. That I could go on for about an hour about, but I won't. I'll just say, if someone is selling you a policy telling you you're going to be able to take that cash out tax-free in the future, in my opinion, it better be a big policy. It better be big enough to make that worthwhile. Because when you get these really large policies, you know, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, $30,000 a month going into a policy like that,
mm-hmm.
you can build a pile of money that you can take out tax-free in the future.
Do you get taxed on it when you take it out or no?
Not if you take it out by loaning it against the policy, which is why I say the policy has to be so large.
Okay.
Because if you still want some death benefit, you want to be able to borrow some money against the policy and still keep your death benefit. So there's another interesting part. When you take money out of your whole life type, mm-hmm. Out of your permanent life insurance policy, how do you do it? Some people will cash it in. They get a policy, it's got some cash value in it. They see the cash value and they don't think they need the death benefit. So they cash it in and they take the money.
Mm-hmm.
That becomes taxable.
Okay.
That's then a taxable event. Now, I have to say, of course, my disclaimer, I'm not an accountant, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that becomes taxable. If you borrow the money against your own death benefit, it's a tax-free transaction as long as you didn't reach that MECA guideline we're talking about. So let's say you have a $5 million policy
mm-hmm.
and it's built up, I don't know, $300,000 of capital. These are ridiculous numbers, but let's just use them. If you take out, you know, $200,000 as a loan against the policy, you don't have to pay it back. You're borrowing your own death benefit. It will accrue interest. So the loan will continue to grow against your death benefit.
Mm-hmm.
But if you die, they just subtract it from the death benefit.
So I'm assuming that you
$4.8 million.
I'm assuming that you would recommend then always borrowing against and not taking it out and getting that big tax penalty.
Usually, yes.
Okay.
I mean, there are times that it makes sense. I've seen people who have built up more cash value than their death benefit is.
Oh.
You know, it's an old policy that a parent bought for them when they were a child or something. They've built up, you know, $15,000 of cash value and they only have $5,000 death benefit.
Mm.
Well, if they die, the company's going to pay that death benefit. So they might as well take out the cash value now,
right.
Use it for something, maybe buy more death benefit with it if they have to,
mm-hmm.
right? So there, I mean, it's tricky. What you need to do is find an insurance agent that you can trust who's speaking to you and helping you sort these things out in some way that makes sense. I mean, us trying to go through, you know, a life insurance tutorial in half an hour is tricky at best and mm-hmm. certainly not, you know, conclusive. So yeah, I said I wanted to talk about Big Dave for a minute.
Okay.
So Big Dave is talking, I think, about another kind of life insurance which is called guaranteed issue or guarantee issue, depending on who you speak with. Guaranteed issue is something you see it from AARP and some other companies. Sometimes you'll get a flyer in the mail that says no exam necessary, you know, answer three medical questions or no questions, no exam necessary. And there's always some tricky phrase like your premiums will never go up or your death benefit can never go down. Right. Usually what the way these things happen is, yes, they will issue them on a guaranteed basis. For instance, I've seen people who have somebody in their family who is terminally ill. They know it. There's no money to pay for a funeral. And the person's been given 2 years to live. Right. Well, they might roll the dice and say, we're going to take out a guaranteed issue product because they're not going to get issued any other kind of insurance. And we're going to make these premium payments, hoping, of course, that their loved one lives longer than the entry period, which is usually 2 or 3 years. And so the way it works is something like this. Usually, you're going to pay in your premiums. If the person dies after, say, the three-year mark, you're going to get the whole death benefit. So let's say you're buying a $10,000 policy and you're paying in, you know, $200 a month or whatever the premium is. If they die after the three-year mark, they've basically made the grade and you're going to get paid the full death benefit. If they die prior to the three-year mark, you will usually, I know AARP had a product like this, I don't know if they still do, but you would get all your premiums back that you paid plus some interest. And they had a pretty good thing. It was like if they died in the second year, don't quote me on this, but it was something like you got 25% more than your money back or whatever. So you get a reduced death benefit, but it still might be worth doing. Because you know you're going to get all your premiums back anyway if you take that kind of policy. But read the small print because it may not be that way. I mean, I remember that as being one of the better guaranteed issue policies you could buy. But that's, I think, what Big Dave's talking about. And it isn't that people don't want to go through the physicals, although I'm sure, you know, people get frightened about that. But it's pretty minimal what they'll do. They'll usually send a paramed to your house. They'll ask you some questions by phone, you know, they'll get your doctor's records if they need to. But if you're in that situation, maybe not even terminally ill, but just let's say you have a heart problem. Okay, well, you might go for traditional insurance and you might get what we call rated. In other words, you might get a higher premium because you're seen as a higher risk, or you might get declined. If you're declined, you might be calling Big Dave, all right? or preferably searching the market for the best terms you can get on a guaranteed issue contract.
Okay, I have another question on this, which we will get to in the second half. But first, I do want to get your phone number.
Absolutely, Jess. It's 413-773-3333.
And you can go to hugyourmoney.com as well. We'll be right back with the second half of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram. It's coming up on WHMP.
Every day, financial ads claiming to be different from the competition. Are they? I'm Francis Ram, the Money Doctor, and I'm about to make a bold statement. I believe the thing to focus on isn't their uniqueness, it's yours. No one has the same financial situation or needs as you, and no one can help us help you better than you. But the truth is, when it comes to managing money, most of us are not as successful as we'd like to be. No matter how focused we are, it's almost impossible to separate emotion, and being in a relationship can further compound the issue. That's why I developed Hug Your Money. Financial coaching, coupled with online software and tools to empower you to manage money wisely. We guide you every step of the way to resolve immediate issues and plan for your financial future with modeling scenarios. So whether it's debt, budget, retirement planning, or a financial crisis, having a Hug coach in your corner is like having a new best financial friend. Hug Your Money is as unique as you are. In fact, it's patented. Visit hugyourmoney.com.
Welcome back to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram. Hi, I'm always happy when you're still there.
Well, and I can still access my life insurance policy, evidently, if I didn't die within my term.
I had a question that I wanted to ask you kind of about Big Dave. So when you're laying in bed at 2 a.m. and can't sleep and you see those infomercials that are kind of the same thing as Big Dave, where it's like, call now, we're going to guarantee this. It's $5 a month and you can get however much. How do you know if it's a scam or not? Because a lot of those just seem way too good to be true.
Well, they may not be a scam. Like, for instance, Big Dave, who we're giving a lot of free advertising to, and I have nothing, I have no idea whether Big Dave's product is any good or not. So please, you know that we're using him as an example here because you had seen that commercial. It's not necessarily that they're a scam, but they may not be the best deal for you. And that's okay. where I would go to somebody that has some real clout and something to lose, like an AARP who has such a big volume of people that they go and they get really good rates from someone, mm-hmm. you know, from a company. I think I remember that contract I was talking to you about was underwritten by New York Life, but it was special terms for AARP. They okay. were competitive terms to New York Life's own policy because they're so big, they can flex their muscle mm-hmm. and they can get something like that done. So when you're looking for something like that, you certainly can go to an independent broker, right? Rather than just dialing up the phone, you could call somebody like us or any independent broker and say, I'm looking for some life insurance. Here's my situation. What do you think would work for me? And get some quotes. There are some companies that you can call and just, you know, pretty much any company that you can call and get quotes from. Mm-hmm. I would say it's been my experience. It's not necessarily always true. But when you get the flyer in the mail that says, just check this box and pay this much and there's no premiums or anything due, you know, maybe go shopping.
Yeah.
It's, you know, that's a little too easy to just, for me to just say, yeah, tick the box and pay the money.
So I was going to say, you know, if you're listening to this show right now and you don't have life insurance and you're thinking about getting it, what are the first steps? What are the first things you would look for? Obviously, I think you said, you know, call a broker.
Yeah, I think so. But before you do that, I think start to think about why you need life insurance, if you need life insurance, and what it does for you. Here's some examples.
Okay.
Let's say, as I said earlier, maybe you're a person with a family, and if you pass away, they cannot make ends meet without you, mm-hmm. right? Okay, that's a reason to put some life insurance on yourself. Now, people will say, well, it's expensive. I don't want to pay those premiums. Think about it this way. If you were paying $100 a month for a premium, I forget whether it's affordable for you or not, just for this exercise. But let's say you're paying $100 a month for a premium and you're buying a $100,000 term policy. Mm-hmm. How long would you have to shell out $100 a month to lose the game? I mean, you're leveraging your money by so much when you buy life insurance. Mm-hmm. You pay $100 and you die tomorrow, they pay $100,000.
Right.
That's the life insurance game. You're probably never going to pay in $100,000 in premiums at $100 a month, right, to cover that death benefit. So that's the idea, is that you can use your money to leverage it. So that's one example of when you might need life insurance. Another is, let's suppose you have 3 kids at home mm-hmm. and, you know, your spouse could do okay, but the kids can't get through college without that money. Mm-hmm. That's a reason for life insurance. Here's a very simple one. You have plenty of money. You don't care. Your spouse is going to be fine. Mm-hmm. Really want to spend down those assets, you know, for your burial and for other things? Or do you just want to leverage your money and spend a few dollars and buy some life insurance? They're going to get the proceeds. Beneficiaries get life insurance proceeds tax-free. So, you know, you might, let's say you're a multimillionaire. So pick up a few million of life insurance for next to nothing. You know, mm-hmm. it doesn't cost you much to do it. And if you die, that money is available tax-free. Instead of them having to liquidate assets, to do things like pay a mortgage on your home until it gets through probate mm-hmm. or on your investment properties or something like that. We talked about a key man policy or a buyout policy for a partner. You might need life insurance for that. When do you not need life insurance? Well, if you're not concerned about your burial costs at all, some people prepay their burial costs mm-hmm. and they simply don't care. They don't have assets to protect. They don't care about, they don't have any debt. Mm-hmm. Right? Their spouse is going to be okay. They don't have children going through college. I hate to say it, but I'm an example of this, right? I'm a single person with no children, no worry, you know, I can pay for whatever I want, right? But I have life insurance. Mm-hmm. And I have life insurance because it leverages my money. Why would I not spend a pittance, relatively speaking, and leave somebody a lot of life insurance? And in my case, you know, it's family members and charity, mm-hmm. right? So you might not need life insurance, but you might want life insurance. I can fund a school or a project about Bengals or whatever I want to fund with my life insurance when I die for almost no money, and they're going to get it tax-free.
Mm-hmm. Which is smart.
So, yeah. So to simplify that, I think you need life insurance first to cover your burial costs, second to cover any income that might be needed, third, to protect your assets and send your kids to college, right? But that's income related. And fourth is just because you want to. You want to give back to somebody. Mm-hmm. And rather than leaving them all your assets, you leave them a life insurance policy. It's a great way to give to charity, for one thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if your spouse comes to you and says they want to take out a $5 million policy on you, at what point should you go to the police? I feel like this is how every Dateline starts.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point, because especially in our state, we have some rules about who has to sign and when they have to sign, right? Like for your retirement. So, you know, I don't know that you go to the police. I mean, I have a couple that came to mind immediately when you said that, because he did call me and say, it was $10 million, but I want a $10 million policy on
my
wife.
You and Keith Morrison are going to be sitting down together very soon. I'm just letting you know
now. Oh, my gosh. Well, I hope not, because I have her on video saying, yes, I want it. And then she said, but I want a $10 million policy on him.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was reasonable. And we actually talked about it, and it turned out that they didn't quite need that. I think we did 8.5 on each of them or whatever. But whatever it was, we found something within their price range that covered them both. And we talked about all those reasons that they have to have it or want it. And again, for them, it was largely about protecting a business, protecting assets, making sure their kids were okay when they were gone. What if their kids ran the business into the ground? Can they still survive?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The real kinds of life things that people think about. I want to talk about term insurance before we end this, though, because, you know, it gets a bit of a bad rap sometimes, or mm-hmm. too good of a rap, depending on who you speak with. Because people say, well, term insurance, it's cheap, it covers my death benefit, it's great, and I'm not going to need it when I'm older mm-hmm. because I'll have plenty of money.
Okay, we hope.
It might be true.
Right.
But what happens if you do need it?
Mm-hmm.
And here's the thing. We talked about guaranteed life, guaranteed issue, because I don't think people really know the nuts and bolts of it. And for term insurance, I want to bring up this topic, because this is maybe the most important reason to pick up term insurance when you can't afford or don't want a more expensive policy.
Okay.
Most term insurance is what we call guaranteed renewable or guaranteed convertible.
Okay.
And what that means is that when you're young and healthy and you can afford the $25 a month premium to buy your $250,000 policy,
mm-hmm.
you are protecting yourself in the future, yourself, not your family. I mean, you are protecting your family, but you're protecting yourself in the future in case you become uninsurable or rateable. In other words, let's suppose you're young and healthy now, you pick up $25 a month and you pay the term.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say it's a 30-year term policy.
Okay.
And you're 25 years old. By the time you're 55 years old, you might have some health problems.
Mm-hmm.
You might have diabetes, for instance. It doesn't have to be some terminal disease, right? Maybe you just have AFib, okay? But that might mean that you may not be eligible for reasonably priced or eligible at all for a whole life policy or even another term policy.
Mm-hmm.
However, the term policy you have is probably guaranteed convertible, which means that they will have to, even if you're terminally ill, they have to convert that insurance if you ask them to, some or all of it, you get to choose,
mm-hmm.
To some form of permanent insurance. And you're going to get it based on your healthy rate you bought it at mm-hmm. when you were 25.
So that's kind of a benefit to buying early.
It is, because if you got, let's say, a preferred non-smoker rate, you know, you're out there running marathons and you don't have to be that. You just have to be in good health and mm-hmm. non-smoking. But if you get preferred non-smoker rates, you're going to get a very inexpensive premium. Get to age 55 or 60 or 65, and now you maybe have some health problems, you're still going to get a preferred non-smoker rate, but you will have to pay for it at your current age.
Mm-hmm.
Still, it's a great deal if you want to convert some of it. And what some people do is they pick up, you know, $500,000 term when they're young. And by the time they're getting to retirement, they're looking at, okay, my term policy is going to end. Maybe I should convert some of it. Maybe they convert $50,000 to mm-hmm. permanent insurance and they let the rest of it go or whatever. Or they do some sort of term and whole life blend. But it's really worth it for people with a term policy. Anybody listening to this who has a term policy, who is just living under the idea that my term policy will end and then what?
Mm-hmm.
You should check to see if it's guaranteed convertible and maybe get some quotes from your broker. Hey, what would it cost me to convert 25,000 of this? 50,000, 10,000? What can I do? Mm-hmm. Find out what your options are while you have that term insurance in place. Don't just let it end without knowing what it does. That's perhaps the most under-exercised value point I could give you today, is to check on your term insurance and see if you want to start converting pieces of it. You could even convert, you know, I want to convert 25,000 this year. Mm-hmm. I'm going to convert another 25,000 next year. things like that. And your broker should be able to help you do that.
Quick question about back to what we talked about in the beginning with the employee that usually offers you if you want to do one, two, three times your salary for insurance. If you have a separate whole life insurance, do you need to do that? I mean, it seems like with the employee, it's really cheap to be able to do that. Is it smart to just do that in addition?
Yeah, I think for the money they charge you. I mean, it was $7 a right. paycheck or something to get three times your salary. I think it is a really good idea to do that. You do, however, want to check with your HR people and see if your employer is offering you accidental death benefit or real life insurance. I mean, I've seen some people, believe it or not, paying a premium that they thought and it looked like it was high enough to be real life insurance. And really, it was for an accidental policy. It only paid if they were in an accident or if they lost one limb or one eye or one hand, you know.
Okay.
And they were paying these premiums for something that may or may not ever happen, which is fine if they're really cheap premiums. You know, you see that ADD
right.
on your, you know, it's $1.15 or whatever. That might be worth it. But just know what you got. I mean, that's the whole deal is ask your broker, ask your HR person, have some independent person take a look at it and help you sort through it. But know what you have. And really, it can be such a tool for people. I mean, you know, we don't talk about it very often because it sort of is one of those, I don't know, it's sort of one of those background things. People go, yeah, and I have some life insurance. And then I say, do you know if it's whole life or term? I don't know. Does it build any cash value? I don't know. I think so.
Yeah.
How much is it? I'll say, how much is the cash value? They'll say $200,000. I say, that's the cash value? I don't know. That's what they pay when I die. That's your death benefit, right? So we just don't talk about it. Nobody wants to talk about dying. And nobody certainly wants to talk about buying a policy that they must die within the term of, Jess.
Right. I don't think they're hiring me for the advertising campaign for that.
Well, you know, you could be little Jess, you know? I don't know.
If you think you're going to kick off within 10 years, we'll pay you.
I love that you say things like that because I think it's what we all think, you know.
Just don't say.
I'm sending this money out. What good is it to me? I'm going to be dead.
Yeah.
But there are features that you can access when you're alive, especially in some form of permanent insurance. But yeah, just know what you've got. Use it to protect your assets. Use it as an estate planning tool. You know, I hear this often. People say, well, I'm going to leave my house to my son or daughter. Now, if you leave it to your spouse, it's not such a big deal. But you're leaving it to a child. If you haven't done a life estate, a legal document to do that, then, you know, they're inheriting your house. Well, that's fine. But now your will is in probate, maybe for 6 months, maybe for longer. Just because you have a will doesn't mean they get the money immediately. It has to go through probate court.
Right. And are they going to have the money to run that?
Yeah. A mortgage, repairs, whatever. And the life insurance, you know, they'd have it in a week, 10 days in their hand, tax-free.
All right. Well, let's get your phone number. There's a lot to this. So let's get your phone number if people have questions.
Sure. It's 413-773-3333.
All right. Perfect. You can also go to hugyourmoney.com. We'll be back next week with another episode of the Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram, right here on WHMP. Thank you.
Thank you, Jess. Have you heard about Get the Tea? It's an online herbal supplement company with high quality standards. You cannot find these in stores. They carry cleansing teas and targeted herbal supplements for all your health needs. Go to getthetea.com today to order yours. Health shouldn't be put off. It should be a priority. And check out their specials page for sale items. That's getthetea.com. Enter code TEA123 for 10% off exclusively for my listeners. Getthetea.com, code TEA123. Order today.
This is Frances Rayum, the Money Doctor. Now you can become 100% debt-free, budget successfully, and retire well, all under the Hug Your Money umbrella.
If I don't blame her for what happened, I blame myself. As long as I'm working and making some money, I'm happy. Rather than argue with her about stuff, I would just say, oh, whatever, do what you need to do. And the same thing for her sometimes. The friction, and it was just causing trouble in our relationship because I wanted to say, we don't have the money for this, you can't buy that. But yet, I don't want to deny it to her.
Because I do all the books, he has no idea about the budget. He has no idea what I have to do to manage a budget. Actually, I don't believe very much in fairy godmothers. But mama.
Debt, budget, retirement. HUG works best when we work together. Schedule your free consultation with a Hug Your Money coach today. Visit HugYourMoney.com. Hug Your Money. So unique, it's patented.
Financial literacy and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Rayum.
Welcome to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the money doctor, Dr. Francis Ram. And I love the shows where we have a guest. And who do we have with us today?
John Sawsville, a mergers and acquisition consultant from Platform Brokerage. So welcome, John.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Doing great.
We're well, thanks. How are you?
Good, thank you.
So you have what I would call a very interesting career. Not many people, I would say get to, but not many people have the opportunity to help somebody sell their business. And I asked you to be on the show today, partly because I see clients who have small businesses. I know we always think of mergers and acquisitions as enormous company things, but I have people who have small businesses who sometimes, you know, they don't know what to do as an exit strategy. And they call me and they say, I want to retire. And I think my business is worth, you know, $1 billion, or I don't think my business is worth anything because I'm the only person doing it. So I wanted to bring you on to talk a little bit about those kinds of things, big deals, small deals, what it's like to live a day in the life of John Sawsville's shoes. So where do you think we should start, John?
Honestly, the topic in general is pretty interesting to most people, because if you own a business, you generally think about when you're going to sell your business. So to me, it's a great opportunity to work with people just on the basis that it's usually one of their best days when they sell their business. And also in a good acquisition, it's one of the best days for the buyer as well, because they're very enthusiastic and excited about what's to come in the future. So it's a really fun and exciting world to live in. And honestly, it's my dream job. So I also get pretty excited about it on a daily basis.
Did you acquire your business from someone?
I did not acquire my business from anyone. We have acquired businesses, but as far as like our brokerage businesses, we built them from the ground up. And most of our operational businesses, we also have built from the ground up. We've made, between me and my partners, we've acquired 3 businesses of the 10 or so that we've operated. So we have experience buying and selling on our own. I've sold a lot more businesses of my own than I have purchased others.
My only reference that I have to this is from Pretty Woman. Richard Gere was in mergers and acquisitions, but they were hostile takeovers.
Yes. Yeah. Richard Gere was involved in a little bigger deals than I usually am. Uh-huh. Mergers and acquisitions advisors and business brokers, you know, there's all sorts and sizes of deals. I tend to work on stuff under 20 million sale price, usually in the ballpark of $1 to $5 million. So it's a more typical small business. And but there's a lot of the same workings that occur, whether it's a really small business or it's a very large business.
Mm-hmm. When you take on a client, is the first thing valuation?
It is. That's generally one of the first things that we do is we provide free valuations. So we have an initial conversation about their business, about their aspirations for the future, that there's a real reason that they want to sell, which to me, the major reasons you want to sell are you're retiring or you're an entrepreneur and you want to move on to your next idea. So I try to make sure that there's a good reason that somebody wants to sell, and then work with them on evaluation. Mm-hmm. From that point, they decide whether they want to move forward.
You know, John, you said that the day somebody sells their business is maybe their best day for both the seller and the buyer, but it also has to be a little bittersweet. As someone who's built his own businesses from the ground up, you understand the heart of an entrepreneur. So do you have a story maybe of maybe a time where you got a phone call after the closing where somebody said, this was the greatest thing, thank you so much, or you know what, I'm really having trouble dealing with this. I don't know who I am if I'm not running this company. What do I do, John?
That's a great question. That is a great question, because I've had both of those occasions. So most sellers, they're proud of themselves and they don't really believe that anybody else can operate their business like they could. And that's a good seller. Like when somebody tells me nobody can do what I can do, that's a business I want to sell, because I know that they've really put everything into their business. I've had a lot of fearful sellers, a lot of people that really didn't believe. And you have to understand, many people that I've sold their business, they hadn't taken a vacation or 10 or 15 years. Every single day was running their business. So it's very much part of them. And it's very scary when they don't have it anymore. And I often get calls of, what do I do with my money? What do I do next? What should I be doing on a daily basis? And a lot of these people are my friends at that point. So they're fun conversations. But yeah, there's many people that get scared in the process. And thankfully, I've had many occasions when people call me and say, I didn't really believe that I could sell my business. I didn't believe that somebody else could step in and run it. And they're just ecstatic that their business is being operated well, that they got out, they got the money that they wanted, and everything in their life is running smoothly. So it is, it's a scary thing, but it's often after the fact they realize they got everything they wanted out of it.
Boy, you brought up so many things. You were talking and I was just thinking, well, wait, there's a vacation? Wait, there's a process? Okay. So it does make me think about something. You know, valuing your business and selling your business and finding the right partner and doing all of that is not an overnight thing. And so I could imagine that you would end up doing your job well and collecting friends along the way. When you do transition a business from one owner or one company to another, but when you're doing that and you're hoping that the next person will pick it up and run it well, that transition has to be a difficult one. Can you talk a little bit about how you, you know, how you phrase it to people? Do they have to be a partner? Do they have to just hand it off quickly? What is that process like when somebody is taking over someone else's business?
That's another great question. You must have sold some businesses in the past, Francis. So honestly, to me, there's two main points in the selling process. And one is that the broker and the seller are on the same page as what the assumed value of the business is. So a good valuation, understanding valuations in the industry that you operate, and then so you get to a point that's reasonable, that the market's going to see you're looking for the right thing. Yes, and then yes. The next piece is what you said, finding a partner. It's truly finding a partner. It's not finding a buyer, because you're going to work intimately with this person. You are both going to have operational responsibilities in the transition. And post-transition, a good seller is still involved with the buyer's life. They're making sure that the buyer has a good experience, has a good ramp to launch themselves into the new business, and has the ability to create their own relationships with the clients of the business. So the partnership to me is the most important part. And finding, look, there, every person has a different person that should be their partner. So that matchmaking is, to me, the most critical point of the sale and of the broker's job.
Cue the fiddler on the roof. Okay.
Do you find that with your clients that they're usually pretty accurate on the valuation, or is it similar to like a home when the seller always thinks their house is worth more than it actually is or less?
It's very much all over the board, right? I think it's very rare that people actually have an accurate understanding of the value of their business. Mm-hmm. Most people overvalue their business, but it's pretty surprising how many people are completely surprised by the value that I can tell that we're going to be able to get. I have a buyer right now, or a seller right now, that's we just did a valuation on, and he just said to me, he's like, I can't believe we can get that much for our business.
That's
and,
awesome.
And he's like, I honestly wouldn't sell until you told me we can get that much. So it is, those are the ones that I love, honestly, mm-hmm. right? It's like, it's easier to tell somebody that their business is worth more. But most people, when it comes to selling, they end up at a reasonable place.
If they do overvalue, though, how do you navigate that?
It's difficult, right? Because much like having children, I mean, this is something that people have spent every moment of their day working on. Mm-hmm. They see the value that they put into it. They see the money that they put into the equipment that they use for the business. And so there's so many aspects to a seller as far as how they come up to the value. where somebody valuing the business, you're mostly looking at how well does it perform earnings wise. Mm-hmm. And you're using valuation and multiples off of that baseline. So a lot of it is, you know, an education of getting people up to speed. But then once they're there, it's, you know, how willing they are to accept the professional across the table from them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember working with a client with you saying, you know, their business is all potential. How do you value potential, right? So it's one thing to say, okay, here's your book of sales, multiply it times this. This is what your business is worth. But what do you say to somebody who says, for instance, I don't know, I'll choose a plumber for lack of a better example. How do you say to somebody who has a plumbing business in an area where there are no other plumbers, but they've only got 1/10 of the business, and you're trying to figure out what is their business really worth to another company that could bring in more people to handle a whole area? Is it a simple calculation? How do you convince a buyer and a seller that even though the business is only doing X number of dollars now, the real potential is this much and they need to pay for that?
Again, you guys are bringing up great stuff. You know, I often discuss with buyers and sellers an opportunity sale versus a cash flow sale, right? And a cash flow, I mean, you can be looking at EBITDA, you can be looking at a net or gross profit. I mean, there's so many numbers that you can value a business off of. The opportunity sale enables us to look at what the opportunity in the market is and then base a valuation off of that, where a cash flow sale is 100% off of what the earnings of the business are. So you have to decide what methodology is going to work for your client and what you're also going to be able to get from buyers.
Okay. Well, we're going to come back for a second half with John Sosbill and learn more about mergers and acquisitions at all levels. But I'm going to kick it to Jess for the moment.
All right. We will have more with the money doctor, Dr. Francis Ram, coming up next on Financial Fitness right here on WHMP.
I'm not sure if opposites attract, but most couples differ greatly in their views about household finances. I'm Frances Rayum, the Money Doctor, with Hug Your Money. Money is a very volatile topic, and most seem to either argue about it or rarely discuss it. A sort of division of labor emerges, one partner becoming the steward of household finances, the other less directly involved. This arrangement may work until a stressor is introduced: college expenses, budgeting issues, impending retirement, etc. That's when sparks can fly. Each person's perspective is quite different, and it's likely only a short-term solution, if any, will arise. The HUG plan presents an easy-to-follow, long-term solution that helps get both partners on the same page, alleviating stress and inspiring them to manage their finances successfully. I'm Frances Ray, I'm the Money Doctor. We now offer advanced tools and financial coaching using our patented system, all under one umbrella. For more information and to schedule your free consultation, visit our website at hugyourmoney.com.
Welcome back to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram, and a very special guest. Who do we have with us?
John Sosbill, a mergers and acquisition consultant from Platform Brokerage. And John, I wanted to talk to you through the whole break, but we had to let our listeners listen in a little bit about this. So can you talk to me a little bit about the way that you work? Is it commission only? Do you charge a fee as you do this? And how is that perceived and accepted by people?
Yeah, we do work on straight commissions. So sometimes we will get hired as consultants. So I have done a good bit of consulting work. I tend to try not to. We really focus on just selling businesses. So everything's free until it closes. So it's a pretty straightforward process. The valuation is free. All the work that we do as far as marketing the business, preparing the confidential information memorandum and the financial deck. So all the preparation is free. And then at closing, we get paid our fee. So there's really little risk to putting your business up for sale, because if it doesn't sell, you don't pay a dime. Not everybody works that way, but that's what we feel is fair. And that's how we're paid.
So that's fascinating to me, because it tells me a couple of important things. The first is you have to be very good at understanding what businesses are worth and whether you can sell them, or you would be doing a lot of work for free forever and be out of business by now. And the second is, you said, well, there's really no risk to putting your business up for sale, which might be true for the seller, but it isn't true for you. If you're going to put forth all of this effort and energy and work and offer your expertise, you have to feel pretty solid that you're going to have a payoff at the end. And I would think that as a buyer, that's a very comfortable thing to see, to hire somebody who has skin in the game only if you get paid. So I think it's a very bold and confident way to move forward. And I just really appreciate that and admire that. Yeah. Have you ever had a big deal where you've put a lot of, or even a small deal, but where you've put a ton of effort into this, like, and you're sure it's going to happen, and then something falls apart and you just can't, not just that the buyer and the seller don't agree, but that you cannot sell the business at all. Something has really happened where, I don't know, maybe somebody lied to you and told you the business was something it wasn't, or do you remember a disaster like that you would be willing to share with us?
I do. I've had a few occasions. But if one specifically, there's a lot of work you got to do. There's a lot of work. There's a lot of risk. There's a lot of problems that can pop up. And so a lot of it is understanding where the problems are going to occur, and that my team and that I do the work up front to make sure the business is truly ready to sell. So I had a deal where we were almost ready to close. At the time, it was one of the biggest businesses I had ever sold. And this was 2 or 3 years ago. And we found out at the last minute that the seller did not understand his vendor contracts. And he had a contract in place which did not allow him to change ownership of his business. And he also, the transfer would have been unbelievably difficult.
Oh, man.
So there's a positive to the story, which is I sold that business last year.
Oh, good.
So it took several years for him to clean it up and get it to a point where it could be sold, but we sold it at a very high price for the seller as well. So it all worked out good, but it was a complete disaster. And I had wasted months and months and months of time.
I'm just curious, for potential buyers of businesses or sellers of businesses, do you find that there's a common area when deals fall apart, like maybe a top two or three things that usually go wrong? Or is it different in every case?
Bad people.
Oh, okay.
Bad people occur.
Bad people, John? Okay, bad, I'm bad sorry. People. I'm going to need a definition on bad people.
So people misrepresent how much money they have, how much access to money they have, the banking relationships they have, all of the ways that they get through and get all the information on the business. Mm-hmm. So we tend to, hold things quite tight as far as what we share with potential buyers until the buyers prove themselves that they're capable of doing the deal. So it would be people that lied in the process, mm-hmm, to me and to my team, to the sellers themselves. And then at the end, they can't fulfill their deal. Most typical problem.
Yeah, that sounds awful. I want to bring it back to the term partnerships for a moment, because it's a little scary if you're thinking of selling your business as an exit strategy, let's say, right? People get to retirement age or whatever, and they say, I've just discovered that my kids don't want this business. What am I going to do with it? And they decide to sell their business. And there's John Soswell saying, but I'm not looking for a buyer. I'm looking for a partner. My first thing would be, for how long? What kind of partner? John, I'm not trying to buy my business back here. What do you say to them?
What it is, it is terminology, right? It isn't their actual partner, because many people never wanted a business partner, and that's why they ran their business by themselves. So it is a partnership, though. So it's a scary word. It's a scary thing, selling your business, but it's part of the process. Unfortunately, is the two people, the closer they are, the better they get along, the more they enjoy their partnership, the better the transaction is going to go, the better the post-sale is going to go. So to me, it's the most important thing. It is a scary word, but I use it so people understand the closeness of the relationship they're going to have between buyer and seller.
During that process, after the sale, maybe for a limited time, they're partners, but eventually the seller gets to walk away.
Yeah.
That's the idea.
Yeah. At the end of the day, everybody wants to walk away clean, right?
Yes.
So, and honestly, the better the business it is, the cleaner the walk away, right? The more complicated, you know, lack of contracts with your clients, stuff like that, you're going to have more terms. And terms tends to mean carrying a note for the buyer or an earnout structure, but some way that some of the money is still going to be paid over time. So in that way, the partnership lasts as long as that money is owed.
Fair enough.
I was just curious if you've had a situation where you might have multiple buyers interested and you recommend a lower price because it's going to be a better partner.
Oh, great question.
That is a great question. And it's something I had never done until last year. Because I continue as I mature as a M&A advisor, I realize the importance of the partnership. Mm-hmm. So I tend to look for the two people that are going to work together better over time and emphasize that aspect of the business. So I have told people this person is offering a little bit less, but you're probably going to be happier in the long run.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm thinking for the people listening that aren't entrepreneurs or don't run a business or want to sell a business, but they could still relate to this. If you've ever bought a house or a car from somebody who was difficult to work with and you came away feeling like you paid too much, you got a bad deal, whatever, everybody's miserable at the closing table, or they're miserable looking for how they can get their lemon law or go after the dealer for the problems that they have. And it sounds to me like I wish that there was more of a partnership idea during that process, as you describe it, when people are buying a home or buying a car. Look, you know, I mean, I just bought a car from a private seller, and I bought the car partly from him, even though there was another one that was similar, because I felt like this guy was being straight with me. This guy was somebody I liked. I felt like he treated the car well. I wanted to buy that car. And it, you know, we worked out the terms and that was fine. And the other car may have been fine, but you know, I think the guy was not telling me the truth about it. And so it didn't matter what the numbers were. I didn't feel right buying that car. And is it the same thing for buyers when they're looking at businesses? How do they kick the tires?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is through those conversations and through the meetings and really getting to know the person. Because just like you related it to a car sale, it's so much about trust. It is about what person you trust. Do you trust what they're saying? Do you trust what they built? And do you trust that the dream of the future? So like anything, trust is massively important in this process. And so you have to feel that at the end of the day that you trust the other person, both buyer and seller.
Do you recommend that everybody put everything into writing? Like, I'm just thinking about, you know, if I was selling a business, I'd care about what was going to happen to my employees. And the new employer can tell you, I'm not going to make any changes. I'm not going to let anybody go. Can you put into writing, like, you're going to keep those employees for at least 90 days? Or can you put in precautions so the business is going in the direction you were hoping?
You definitely can. So the, you know, outside of the partnership, the next most important thing is the terms of the deal, mm-hmm. right? Everybody thinks about money. Everybody thinks about what is that dollar amount you're going to talk to your friends about. It's not the most important thing. It's, do you have a good partner? Do you have the terms that you want in the deal? And then the price. Mm-hmm. So, and part of those terms would include what's going to happen with employees, the structure of an earnout or a carry. Really, every single aspect of the business can be documented. And, you know, I mean, certain people get to very fine details with their lawyers.
Mm-hmm. For the layman, can you define layout and earn out and carry?
Oh, yeah. So an earn out is, so a carry is a loan from that the seller is giving to the buyer as part of the purchase. So they're buying the business for $1 million. There's a $500,000 carry. So that means there's a $500,000 note that the buyer owes the seller after the sale. An earnout is a similar structure, but it's also judged by the performance of the business. So it's saying, we're going to pay you over a period of time, but you're going to earn that based on the performance of the business. So the business made $1 million last year. This year, it needs to make $1 million to get the full earnout.
Yeah, similar to somebody holding back paper on a house that you're buying or...
Exactly.
You know, having a trail commission, if you will, or something, but tied to the value of the business going forward. So it's very interesting. Do you have maybe a story about a favorite business you sold? Do you have a favorite deal?
I come from the tech industry historically. So I've run multiple types of businesses. We sell multiple types of businesses at this point. But I've sold some big tech businesses, which obviously I get paid more the bigger the business is. So those kind of stand out in my mind, but also it was an opportunity sale. It was something that was very undefined as far as what it was worth. It was one of the most difficult things I've ever had to sell, but I had a big success. And so we were able to get exactly what I predicted we would get. And the sellers were phenomenally happy. Things didn't work out perfectly. But the sellers got their business back. And so they got paid a whole lot of money to end up with a better business than they started with. So that's a pretty happy group of sellers.
You didn't sell Barstool Sports, did you?
No.
He ended up buying it back for $1 after selling it. That's why I thought of that.
Yeah. There you go.
Okay, John. So first of all, I really want to thank you for coming and joining us today. It's an unusual topic. And I just want to ask, do you have one piece of advice you would give somebody who thinks they might be wanting to sell their business? What would you tell them?
I have two bits of advice. One is find somebody to help them sell their business that understands their industry, that has specific expertise in the industry they're working on. Most brokers sell businesses in some area or another, and they have that area of expertise that they're best in. Find the guy that they're best in your industry and work with them. Second, find somebody you really, really like and enjoy working with. You enjoy your conversations during the acquisition process. You trust them as a buyer and you believe that they've been successful in life. Those are the biggest things, is a good partner and a broker that knows the industry. It's going to go a long way.
In parlance, good people.
There you go.
Good people. So thank you again. This is John Sosville from Platform Brokerage. He's a mergers and acquisitions consultant, and I hope you'll come back for another show sometime and we can talk more about this.
I would love to. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This was a lot of fun. All right. Before we go, I want to get your number, Francis.
Sure. They can reach us at 413-773-3333 or, of course, on the web at hugyourmoney.com.
Also want to mention that if you've got a question for the Money Doctor, you can send it to info@hugyourmoney.com or to jtyler@whmp.com. If we use your question on the air, you will get a copy of The Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Rahm's book, available now. Join us next Saturday right here on WHMP for an all-new Financial Fitness with The Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Rahm.
101.5, 1400 WHMP, news, information, and the arts. Emotions and experiences play an important role in our financial decision-making. Every Saturday morning, hear real-life stories and positive solutions to issues we all face when it comes to our relationship with money. Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Francis Rahm. Saturday mornings at 8:30 on 101.5, 1400 WHMP.